deadline for us. For us to know who is here, maybe let me allow the DG to introduce the team, and then we'll take it from there and advise on the way forward. Advocate Milan, over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson, honourable members. I'm back here to speak to the master's offices. The acting chief master is on maternity leave, so I'm the acting chief master at this point in time. So I'm here also in that capacity. Dion Radman, DDG for Legislative Development, is here to deal with issues of legislation. Advocate Nindi Vilakazi is here to deal with litigation issues. She's the chief state litigation officer. Then we have Mr. Marsh and Mr. Mgoni, who are here to speak to the issues of the Justice College. So, Chair, we're all here. Enver has just stepped out, as the Chair has indicated. He's going to be back as soon as it's done. Other officials are still here. The COO is here. Mr. Johnson is here in the CFO's office. So he'll also be familiar with some of the processes in the Master's office. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair. There were nice, humble, sweetheart questions that were asked last night before we adjourned. Let me get some indications as to when are we getting the responses thereof from Joa.
Chairperson, thank you. During the day, we'll get the expenditure projections. I'm busy with finalizing the presentation for you. I'll arrange printouts. The second issue in relation to government departments owing us money, breakdown of the state attorney's fees outstanding. I've got the figure available for you and a breakdown of what departments are owing us. But most probably in Lindiwe's presentation, she will also give you a sense of what is the status. I'm still waiting also for a report from court services on Operation Isondlo. Hopefully, the question raised will be revealed. And I will just submit the report to you. And it's not my domain to report on that particular area. But the report I will provide to you during the day. I'll just confirm with court services.
Thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. That question as well must be responded to. But I think Lindy will deal with it. The question was how many men are supporting kids that are not theirs. So she promised me last night during supper that I should respond to it. So she'll be dealing with it. On that note, with your permission, colleagues, can we allow the DG who is standing in for that master's office to talk to us, and then we'll take it from there. Over to you, DG.
Thank you, Chairperson. I must also, just by way of introduction, advise the House that I did follow the proceedings on TV yesterday, and I noted the questions that were being raised, and I thought that maybe I should just try and offer some information on what is happening in at least two areas that I noted questions were pointed on a bit on Isondlo and a bit on the vacancies, so that when the Chair writes a report on who is to blame, it will be clear. It will be clear, really, who can be blamed on those things. Chair, the other questions, I remember the question Mr. Ntuli raised around the masters. I'll deal with it when I deal with the masters, but just on Operation Isondlo and vacancies. On Isondlo, if you recall, Chair, the main issue is trying to get all of the offices, firstly, to enable members of the public to apply for maintenance quite easily. And how we've responded with that, as indicated yesterday's presentation, we're trying to assist people be able to fill in the form. So the process of just presenting information to be able to apply for maintenance is now virtually an easy one, because you can fill in a form at home, you know, and fill all of the details and come and drop it at the master's office, sorry, at the court office. You can even post it. So the process of application should not be easy. What I forgot to mention yesterday, Chair, which will even help these processes be even easier, is that all of those forms are currently being translated into 11 official languages. So you would be able to go onto the website in due course and be able to print out the relevant form in the language of your choice as a member of the public and fill it in and submit it. So they're currently all available in English, and those that have Afrikaans on them as well, they're available in those two languages at least. But what we are currently doing is having them interpreted. In fact, service providers are already beginning to return some of them. So it's the process of accessing a service to enter into the system, to enter the system by filling in a form, that process should now be relatively extremely easy, because you should be able to fill in these forms anywhere and post them. So for its own purposes, then, the application for maintenance should be an easy one. What we'll then follow through on as an area of improvement is in the employment of appropriately qualified persons to then give you advice. So once you've filled in a form, there's the next step of sitting with an official of the department and getting proper advice. And that is where the recruitment of legal admin officers is important, and paralegals is important, because they are then the ones that we expect will be able to give a very efficient service and a very professional service to the members of the public. Most of the issues that we encounter with maintenance is obviously the tracing of the defaulters. I think it's less of a problem to have, you know, at least people paying, even if maybe there's doubt about the child for whom they are paying. I think the critical problem is finding somebody to pay for that particular child, at least. So the tracing of defaulters is one thing that we are doing pretty strongly. We are beginning to, well, we are successful in tracing them. Because recall, Chair, what we did with Operation Isonle is that we then hired service providers to assist, tracing agents, to assist with the tracing. So if we couldn't trace you as a department, we got service providers to trace you. And also to use the, you know, I think it's called the ITC system, the credit bureau, which has all of the information about a lot of people based on their credit details. So we used the tracing agents, and on the ID numbers that we had of defaulters, we gave them that information to use that system to trace people. Quite a lot of people were traced, and we've paid millions already, in fact, well over 10 million in defaulters that hadn't been paying, were identified and in fact have started paying. We also spent time tracing people who were not coming to collect money. So beneficiaries who had money but had not been coming to collect money because their previous experience wasn't a particularly exciting one and were no longer coming, were able to trace those beneficiaries and actually pay them. We now have less than R1 million in our accounts countrywide of people that we have identified that are beneficiaries that should be collecting their money. So by and large, we've been successful in those two programs. The biggest area where we are still experiencing some challenges is in the hearing of maintenance cases themselves, you know, where there's a hearing involving a magistrate and so forth. And that is a structural program, partly. It will be resolved when the regional court jurisdiction bill gets passed. Remember, Chair, that the current framework of family courts, they are clustered in a way that, you know, people travel from Polokwane and different areas to go to a main seat of a family court because the registrar is located in a particular place. So the clustering is still, of the family court, is still following the same pattern that the previous government had structured the family courts on, whilst they were still divorce courts. And through the regional court jurisdiction bill, we'll resolve that problem, because every regional court, wherever it will be able to hear these matters. So we will be able to decentralize. So that problem will be resolved. And what it will solve for us on a practical basis is the issue of magistrates. Because there's not enough magistrates that hear family matters. The magistrates, the presiding officers, because that's what they are called, at the level of regional court magistrates, they travel across the country. So if a magistrate who's supposed to be in 15 Market Streets has to leave and go to Free State to hear matters there, the matters in 15 Market Street stand still until the person comes back again. So remember that the structure of family court functions on a periodical basis. So they can sit for about maybe a month in one location, but then the presiding officers travel to another location. So periodically, you know, they sit from time to time in a specific court. That's currently the framework. And as a result, therefore, once they are away sitting on circuits elsewhere, those matters do stand. And as I indicated, Chair, the one way that that matter will be resolved permanently is through the regional court jurisdiction bill. What we've been trying to do in the meantime is to try and encourage the appointment of acting magistrates and to persuade the Magistrate Commission and the judiciary to appoint or to recommend for the appointment more magistrates to sit in family matters. That is a matter that regrettably is not within our control. We have to engage the judiciary, and when the judiciary and then obviously responds, which they have been doing quite positively, we then will resolve these matters. But the way of resolving it permanently is through the regional court jurisdiction bill. Also, what is still a challenge is the processes of consultation. When somebody has filled in the form and now we are sitting with them as a department and offering advice, that is the part that takes a bit of time. The part that takes the longest time is after we found the defaulter or the person against whom maintenance is claimed, bringing the two parties together from that time to the time that the matter is heard and the decision and the judgment given, that currently takes the longest time. I think on average we take to between 8 and 13 months to get a maintenance hearing. There are a few cases that take a bit longer than that, you know, because of the processes that I've identified. So the challenge and the critical area that the members of this committee in their oversight would assist us in monitoring is the shortening of that period. So getting a divorce and maintenance is something that we should be able to agree the acceptable average time to be. So if we say from time of application to time of hearing, it should take an average 6 months. Let's identify how we can achieve that period, because it shouldn't take long. If people are no longer keen on being together and that identifiable pretty easily, we shouldn't prolong the process and the suffering while they're together when they actually want to be separate. We should try and facilitate that process and make it as quickly as possible. And then maintenance should follow normally in that course quite easily. So I think that's the challenge we should aim for ourselves to deal with pretty quickly. So that is the period. Now, what takes a bit of time there is that usually the partners against whom maintenance is sought become difficult to trace. So and even if they are found, there's a whole lot of legal issues that come into play because they get a lawyer to assist them, and then once there's litigation, really the matter falls between the lawyers, and there are delays. By and large, people run away by arguing that they can't afford. They put a huge list of expenses, and resulting in a big debate about what they can afford and what they cannot afford. Again, just to give you an indication of what type of problems we face so that the committee can help us in the deliberations about what policy interventions should be made. You know, you find that somebody who's a civil servant, because we find that civil servants are also keenly involved in these matters, you know, who's, let's say, a director or even a person of a higher rank. Because of their status, their expenses tend to be also just as matching of their living standard. And you find that somebody like that would then have a list of expenses and have, let's say, and be able to argue that I then am left with 500 rand in my account. That's typically what happens in divorce matters. You find somebody of standing saying, I've got all these bills, which include a bill for a luxury car, a luxury house, or a penthouse, and they pull these expenses. And they do get to a point where that person really has their whole salary taken up by their expenses. And usually it's those people who come and say, you see, I cannot afford to pay 500 or 1,000 a month. And it becomes a bit of a contradiction, because the other party will see the lifestyle one is living and say, but you should be able to afford 500 to 1,000 rands a month. But the person will be able to show quite objectively that these are my expenses. Now the question is, what type of interventions we should consider making under those circumstances to put those types of people in a position where they pay? You know, the question is, can it be argued that, look, at some point you must consider downgrading? You know, if you are shown to be driving a relatively expensive vehicle, or what would be classified as a luxurious vehicle, maybe we should start making the type of intervention that require you to downgrade and get a cheaper vehicle, so that you reduce the amount of installments so that you can be able to afford. If I hope I'm being very clear, because these are the things that make a lot of, particularly women who apply for maintenance, very irate when they say that I can't get somebody to pay, and I can't understand why the person can't pay, because I know they're living a luxurious life. It's usually when something like that happens, where a person really can show, as you know, we tend to live above our means, even as professionals. So we live a relatively good life, but with a lot of debt. So if I can show, if the basis of calculation of maintenance is on the basis of the of looking at the expenses, I can promise you, Chair, that this problem will go on forever. Because every one of us in this room can right now calculate expenses and will be left with 500 bucks. That's why people sometimes never understand why somebody who's having a good job can say, I don't have money. You know, people sometimes don't appreciate that the expenses tend to match the living standard of that particular person. So when it comes to maintenance, therefore, these are the issues that you find becoming problematic, because lawyers do come and are able to persuade the court that this person can't pay because they've covered their expenses. So to what extent should we start intervening to say, well, if that is the case, maybe move out of a million rand house or 500,000 rand house and take a cheaper house or take a flat, because then your bond would be reduced and then you'd have extra money to pay maintenance. So it really is a policy question about what specific intervention it is, because we'll have to reflect this in law in a way to say that it can't be acceptable. So people must be put in a position where they have to reduce their expenses. Those are some of the things that we've picked up practically that create challenges in the court. The other one, we have debated them in the department. We've looked at a number of countries. People that owe maintenance, because we do find sometimes that people owe thousands, and they keep running businesses. They you know, others even can afford travel. We noted that Malaysia introduced a provision in their relevant legislation where somebody that owed maintenance could not register a company. You couldn't register a company if you owed maintenance. So, and I think, if I recall, I can't remember which country it was, you couldn't get a tax clearance if you owed. So these are the type of things that we've looked at to say, you know, if we are to go around and spend time, because we spend public money, you know, to find a defaulter, we have to employ maintenance investigators. I'm sure that concept the committee has heard of, where we say we employ maintenance investigators, the department spends money buying vehicles. And all really maintenance investigators do is take a file and start tracing somebody by making calls, or they drive to places. It's a waste of money, actually, if you think about it. So we need to find ways that just makes it easy for people to come to us. And some of the interventions that this committee can consider and assist us with considering are the type of interventions of the type that I've described are happening in other countries. So we could say, for example, here, all those people who are defaulters, we submit their names to SARS. And when they fill their tax returns, SARS will be able to pick them up to say you are owing. Maybe let's see how you can first make those types of commitments to pay before we give you a clearance. You know, it will be one way of easily catching people, because if you know that you're owing and you won't get a clearance, it will be in your interest to trace your children so that you resolve those matters. It's one way. We could use the motor vehicle license registration every year to say your vehicle license will not be renewed until you've dealt with issues of debt. Those are things that annually we all do. and therefore we present ourselves to metro offices every year to pay these types of licenses. So people will bring themselves, and therefore it should be easy to trace. What we attempted to do with Operation Stones, if you'd recall in 2006, those were summons issued against them. We provided that information to Metro Police, and what they did is that at roadblocks, they'd also check if there were no summons or warrants of arrest, issued for you for maintenance and for contempt of court. And some people were arrested. Now, that served its purpose, but at the same time, it created other problems. Our biggest concern about these stricter measures are what sometimes are perceived to be backlashes. Because when people get put in a position where they feel hounded on these types of matters, our information is that they then tend to be more difficult to the partners and the children. And it was felt that maybe some of the tougher measures may be counterproductive, and that we should rather try persuasive methods that enable people to voluntarily come forward and engage. So more education was argued for as opposed to the tighter measures. The question really is one that, again, this committee can assist with in terms of deciding what really we should do. Should we continue to have this high level of tolerance of people who are not wanting to maintain children, or we should start introducing maybe a stick to encourage them to come forward? Those are things that we can consider, because preparing legislation as an amendment would be very easy. We can prepare legislation along the lines described, and it could be next year's legislative program. So those are things I thought we should reflect on, Chair, as far as Operation is concerned and consent. Really, tracing defaulters, tracing beneficiaries, we've done well. Where we need to improve more is in reducing the time frame for hearing of matters and just speeding up the quality of the service at a service point. And how we're doing that is employing legally qualified persons to do it. So that's Operation is on that I sure should respond to. What Mr. Johnson can then assist us do, so that we prepare a report, because also the National Assembly, the Portfolio Committee under Chairperson Karim, also requested the same information, is give you greater details per province on what I've described. So we'll prepare a cleaner one. But that information will be reflecting what I've just explained. With respect to vacancies, the issue of vacancies is twofold. Firstly, we definitely were having challenges with our HR in responding. You know, I think officials get really caught up in their day-to-day business that sometimes people overlook their responsibilities. In terms of the processes internally, and this is a management one, you know, HR cannot advertise posts and start recruiting without the sign-off of the line function manager. So what really has been happening is that they've not been proceeding with that because managers have not been focusing in this area, on this area, in their units. So a director who has vacancies in his or her unit has not equally been pushing HR to say, I want this post advertised, I want to run the recruitment process. So naturally, HR also sat back waiting for authorization. But how it came about is that, it came out is that people then looked at HR as if HR is not doing its job, when actually it's the manager who has vacancies in their unit that are the ones to be driving the process, you know, and HR is supposed to facilitate. So with the HR inputs, you know, I then have started putting the managers under pressure, making them more answerable to why they have vacancies in their unit. And it is paying off because they are the ones driving it. Now HR is able to assist them. The obvious challenge, obviously, now is that because there's a high number of posts that you are filling, HR is now under pressure to be everywhere, basically run up at the same time. So the process is still taking a bit longer than we would want. It's purely as a result of the work that we've done. Fortunately, and the figures do bear out, Chair, we really did a lot this year. If you look at our personnel expenditure, I think we're on 98, if not 99% expenditure. And largely because we focused on specific units, as I indicated yesterday. We focused on court services. We also created new posts. And every time we create new posts, the vacancy rate gets higher as well. So I think when you look at the vacancy rate, it's not a rate that is standing still, Chair. it's not a rate that is standing still. You know, if we decide to create more posts of interpreters in the next month, for example, and we create those posts, the vacancy rate then goes higher because those are posts that are created at sign-off and that represents existing vacancies. So the rate goes higher. So we should just be mindful that it's not a static vacancy rate. It's one that fluctuates. We're able to reduce it to about 12% like it is. So don't be surprised if in 2 months' time it's gone to 20%. It will be because between now and then new posts would have been created, so the rate goes up again. Then we have to start a process of recruiting and reducing. So it keeps fluctuating. So we will always obviously be striving to reduce it. I think it will remain relatively high going forward because as we open more service delivery points, we create more vacancies for that area as well. So that's the framework within which we should be considering these things. What we have decided we are going to do to assist the committee is to reflect the extent to which the vacancy rate at any point in time is occasioned largely by new posts being created, so that we'll be able to show you, because I'm sure the concern you have is that posts lie vacant for a very long time. So at least what we should be able to show you is that posts have been vacant not for a very long time. Those that have been vacant for a long time would need to be filled, and that posts would relatively be less than a year in their creation. So that's one way of dealing with the issue of vacancies. If there's anybody to blame, Chair, firstly, it would be line managers. So what would have to do in the submission of information is to indicate to you which branch has the highest vacancies, at which level and which post, so that you can ask the DDGs, you can ask the chief directors, and then obviously, I mean, you can ask myself to say what are we doing. So we're trying to make sure that this gets dealt with in that respect. So that's what occasioned these vacancies. So I thought I should highlight that information, Chair, so that when you do receive the reports that you've asked for, you'd consider them in the context of this, so that if there's any shortcomings in those reports, you'll also be able to follow up. But definitely when you do your site visits, I would offer counsel to say it should assist you if you ask ask for the qualifications of people that are performing the services that I've described, so that you can be assured that at least it is the correct people doing that, and that there's sufficient, there's correct numbers doing that exercise. And the same would apply to the master. So on the master's offices specifically, Chair, the same principle on human resources applies. As indicated, we did a project about which you would have received information during the course of last year called the Right Sizing Project. And really what that project was to make an assessment of the work done in each master's office, determine the level of capacity required for work to be done in that particular office. And once we did that, and we identified the posts that are there, the posts that needed to be created, we created those posts. And then the process of filling those posts started. So as indicated then, we then had just about 700, 800 posts created in the master's office that became vacant immediately, which we advertised. So from between July last year to December last year, we were interviewing and filling posts in the master's office. So by about end of January this year, we had issued letters of appointment to about 649 people. So between January and now, 649 people are joining the various offices. You know, others have just started, others are starting now, started in May, others started in April. So we gave an opinion that said between January and about July, at the latest August, we should still expect complaints about maybe quality of service, simply because people that are starting now are completely new people. Because what we did, Chair, is that we did not renew all contracts of people that were terminating at the end of December. Remember that master's offices, because of the volume, we employed a lot of temps that were always on contract. We found that that didn't serve us well, because if somebody's on contract, they don't have an incentive to want to do well, because their contract is for a year, it's going to expire, they spend time applying for other posts. And because we were rushing to have bodies to assist deal with the work administratively, we also didn't pay enough time to the quality of those people you recruited. So many of them didn't even have the legal qualifications. So it was really a problematic situation, because you want to respond by having bodies to provide a service, but because you are rushed, we are under pressure to respond to the queues that are outside, you end up not doing that well. So we decided to basically take a knock on the chin by saying, let's absorb that public pressure and just explain to people what we are trying to do, and really take short-term losses and short-term suffering for longer-term gain. You know, shed tears now for joy later. So we decided that all contract posts would not be renewed. So we didn't renew them. We sent notices in time. We gave people up to 2 months' notice. And as soon as you get a notice that in 2 months' time you won't have a job, you have no incentive to work hard every day. So we had those problems last year. So many complaints that you would have heard of, and received in your constituencies would have been occasioned by that type of environment. You know, people became quite disruptive in the offices. They wanted to stay employed and that type of thing. But clearly and fairly, we had people that in the long term we did not need and we did not want. Not because they were bad people, but because strategically, the trajectory that we're taking, we were not going to be able to respond to properly if we had those types of people. So now those people have gone, have left. There's very few that are there. The new people that are coming in are completely brand new. They are legally qualified, which is good for us. So in other words, they are trained lawyers in terms of their qualifications. You know, they are trained in administration of estates. They've gone to law school for that. What we are now trying to do is to skill them. You can have a legal qualification, but not necessarily be skilled in that area. So we're spending a lot of time skilling them now, training them. But what we believe is that once they're skilled, because they have the qualification, they will be able to make quicker decisions. And then in the long term, we can give them more delegation to do a lot of things. People that are not qualified and, you know, are not necessarily well skilled, you don't delegate a lot of responsibilities to those type of people. They cause more damage. So we're trying to manage this in this way. So between now then and end of this calendar year, we're spending a lot of time on training. We're spending a lot of time on recruiting, right? And the masters have that. We've now just placed out adverts to recruit 49 people. So those are the outstanding adverts to be done for this exercise. So in terms of capacity, therefore, in each office, this is relatively well. As you bring more people, what it also then requires is that you put computers. So we've put pressure on the other side of things as well. You know, you bring more people, there must be a computer, there must be a desk, there must be furniture, there must be all sorts of those administrative things. So that's also what you are responding to. So the offices are very busy. If I can use the word in inverted commas, it's chaotic in that sense. There's new people starting, there's new requirements, and we can see the path. The good thing is that as soon as people settle down, they actually are able to reduce queues pretty quickly. But also, the new ones that are coming in are being trained, which is my next part of the presentation, on the electronification. Remember I mentioned yesterday that we're moving away from a manual system. I can now safely say to yourself, Chair, that except for the Pretoria office, all the other offices now have their processes electronic in the master's office, especially for the Guardians Fund. The ICMS that I mentioned yesterday includes the master's office. So except for Pretoria, because we've just done, Pretoria is the biggest, we deliberately decided to do it last. Except for that office, all of the offices, we now have all of these green cards captured electronically. So we are able to monitor somebody's file electronically and make entries electronically. And where we are moving to now is to make payments electronically as well. So for a lot of people, we are now paying them directly into their accounts. Now, it's a shock to people to learn all of a sudden that they don't have to go and walk to an office or travel to an office to get their check. And many of them are still refusing. They're still saying, no, I'd rather come and get my money myself. And we're saying to them, no, but you have a bank account, we'll put money for you in your bank account. So we're trying to bridge the trust relationship. So if previously you've had an experience where you always struggled for your money, and the very same people now tell you that don't worry, we'll put money into your account, you sort of initially doubt that they will, and you prefer to receive a check. So we're still having a lot of that, where people come and say, no, don't put money in my account, I want a check. I'll cash it myself and see the money. There may be other reasons why people don't want to have money paid into their account, because maybe there is negative balance. So if you put money in a bank, it disappears by, you know, payments to those negative balances. So we are struggling. And Chair, we're going to have to make a very tough call on this one. I've indicated already that at some point we will definitely refuse to give people checks where they have bank accounts. We will just put money into their bank accounts. Likely because there's a risk in check fraud, which is what we are trying to eliminate in the first place. And, you know, if we continue to keep a check system, the investment that we've made in the electronic systems is not going to be realized, you know, if we're not going to make those tough decisions. So we have to make those tough decisions, but ease them over time and get people to buy, which would be easier. But we're looking at a situation where we just pay directly into people's accounts and advise people by way of SMS that we are doing that. We're engaging with SARS to issue IT3Bs as well via SARS, which would be these slips that inform you. You know, SARS issued these slips that inform you about interest and or money that you SARS is returning to you. We're trying to have a relationship with SARS where we can also issue those for Guardian's Fund to say this is the interest end on your account, so that there's a nice track record of these types of things. So by and large, Chairperson, I'm able to advise the committee that, say for the Pretoria office, the master's office has now gone electronic. The new people that are being recruited are working on electronic system. They're not working on green cards and the manual system. We are just dealing with the outstanding capturing and verification into the electronic system. So we're doing well on this one. We really are. And, you know, we hope that the quality of the service will be better. What we have started also looking into is that, you know, every master's office should be able, because it's electronic, they should be able to go into files of other offices so that we can, in other words, just have view rights so that we can give you information. If you're in Gauteng and you are you have a file in the master's office in Johannesburg, and you relocate or you travel to another location for a few days or so, you should be able to go to any master's office and get an update on your file. You don't have to wait to go back to your office, to the Johannesburg office to get this information. So we're working on that now, so that that information is readily available from any office. So the modernization of processes by using information technology is continuing in this particular master's office, and we hope that we should be able to do well. This should improve the quality of service very greatly. We should improve the quality of service. So we're not going to be tolerant of offices where people spend a lot of time in queues, don't get treated very well, because this information will not be easy to find. What may have created challenges in the past is that people had to go back and look in a pile and pile of files, the green cards and so forth. Now that everything is electronic, we have to do this pretty quickly. The challenge, obviously, about people being reluctant to show their lack of knowledge of use of computers will obviously continue to be there. As Mr. Roo raised yesterday, you know, if you don't recruit right, there's no point, because people tend to want to revert to the manual system. And we found this interestingly in that people opposed, they kept saying, no, this is not working, the system is not working. And we found it strange that a lot of people kept saying the system is not working, until we went to them to say, please show us what happens when you work on the system so that you can see where it's not working. Then it became clear that people can't use computers. So it was easier to say the system is not working, because we're then able to, we would then say to them, okay, use the manual system while we check out the system, and everything was fine. But when you got there and we sent people to the offices, it became clear that, no, actually, this person can't use a computer, and we had to train them. They could use a computer maybe just to send an email, but they couldn't work on the system, and we had to train them on the system. So as that gets done, it's much, much better. So I'm happy to say that the incidences of new fraud, check fraud, are actually lessening and lessening on a regular basis, and it's actually quite interesting. But we are finding new incidences of new fraud in that people are using the system and find ways around the system. So if people are of a criminal mind, you know, they're really like syndicates. I mean, you improve law enforcement, criminals always find a new way around the particular issue. banks have eliminated cash fraud, people have moved to credit card fraud, you know, so the way you move, I mean, it's also another, you know, it's a lifestyle, that side. Why do we have a normal life, this side? People view the other life as a normal life for themselves, you know. So, in other words, we're just trying to make sure that our systems are such that we should detect these things much quicker. So an elimination, a total elimination, would be very difficult to promise, because there are people who would always look at the Guidance Fund as a place where there's just money to try and exploit. But we're discovering less and less of check frauds and so forth. Most of the cases are old cases. If we discover them, it's things that happened a while ago. So our systems, I think, are good in that way. It's harder to commit fraud now. The advantage of an electronic system is that if you do something bad there, it's easy to audit it, because we know who was last on the system, who was making what entries. So if you try to do something wrong, we'll pick it up on the system. And you can always approach a person to say, we see here there was an attempt to do something that the system doesn't allow. What were you trying to do? And so forth and so forth. So in that sense, it is pretty interesting. And I think what would be also useful is if members of the committee are able to find time to go to an office, they can go to a master's office and ask to be shown how the system works, so that you can really see. So the challenges that we have now are just getting people used to working electronically, and with time, that will be okay. So all of the offices are done. The third point that I thought I should raise around the Guardians Fund is that there are offices that still don't have the Guardians Fund. You know, when you get under pressure, especially from public pressure, and maybe to some extent, pressure from, portfolio committees, the temptation is always to respond, to make the pressure go away, without looking at issues strategically, whether you're doing the right thing. Historically, because of the pressures around the Guardians Fund and the pressure to improve the system, in offices where there was a problem, the department responded by saying, okay, this office we have a problem with. Let's remove the Guardians Fund from this office and take it to Pietermaritzburg. So we have people in Devon, which is why Mr. Ntuli would have challenges there, is that the Devon office doesn't offer the Guardians Fund. So people from around Devon have to go to Pietermaritzburg. And you'd ask yourself, but why would you do this? It's simply because it is a small office, and it was felt that Maritzburg is a bigger office, therefore it has better capacity. Not realizing that what you are doing to Pietermaritzburg is that you are putting them under the same pressure and same problem. So instead of fixing Durban, instead of fixing Bisho, instead of fixing UMTAT, you take Guardians Fund there and you take it to Grahamstown. And then you make people travel to Grahamstown. So what we are doing now is taking these files back to their office, where they are supposed to be, you know, so that we fix the problem there. The challenge, I think, in all of the master's offices is the question of space. UMTATA office, for example, we can't afford to put even one person now, because that's how full it is. We've looked around UMTATA, there's no space anyway. So again, we're trying to buy and find land to build new offices there, bigger offices, and we're hoping to just use the electronic system to make it unnecessary for people to travel. You know, we can work off-site, people can fill in the forms, send them electronically. So we're trying to get to that stage where, you know, if everything, as much as possible, can be done without trips back and forth, we're trying to get there as much as possible. But really, strictly speaking, just like opening a bank account, you should only go to your main bank once in a while. The rest of the things, you should be able to print your slip, your statement at any ATM. So similarly for us, we should be able to give you an update on your Guardians Fund file from anywhere, basically. And that's where we're trying to get it, through this electronification system. So if somebody says, I had to go to that office which is far away, and they're complaining to yourselves, you should be able to say to them, but why didn't you go to the nearest office? Because we know the department has got an electronic system. You can get the same information there. So some of this thing is about just knowledge. People don't know that these things are there because, we're not communicating enough. So that's the third aspect that I thought is important, and that we are doing in all of these. For purposes of audit qualifications, We're now hoping that really we should be able to reconcile. We should be able to reconcile our books as much as possible. You know, we've got all of the cards, information on the cards now available electronically. We can trace payments. Now we are working on reconciling figures, comparing the right entries, that the entry that was made on the card for 500 matches the receipt, you know, that is there. We were finding some discrepancies where the entry is made for 500, but maybe it's entered as 495 or 450. We're trying to do the actual figure verifications and double checking. So that one is taking time. And we'll be opening bank accounts. I'll just check with the CFO's office which offices still don't have bank accounts, because when you move these things, we just try to centralize. In my experience, centralizing functions is the worst thing to do if you're a manager, because you just pile work centrally. But if it's done in the right locations and you spend time capacitating the right locations, you tend to move pretty fast. So we're working in that particular way to resolve this problem. So all of the offices really now are 90% ready for an audit. We are 90% ready for an audit, and we should be correct. Pietermaritzburg and Pretoria are between 60 and 70% ready, but we're expecting that in the next 2 months they'll be ready for a full audit. Now, there are other extenuating factors now that make our work a bit difficult. You know, when people present ID documents, and copies of ID with fingerprints, what is now taking a bit longer is our verification of the information with Home Affairs. You know, we spend a lot of time with Home Affairs trying to get confirmation that this is the correct person. And we're trying to engage with them at a higher level to say, let this process be seen as just as important as applying for an ID. Because we can't process very quickly until we are confirmed that you are the right person. Largely because we're quite used to having to deal with ID fraud. There's a lot of ID documents that are fraudulent out there, and you know, people, syndicates use them as a main basis for claiming in the Guardian Fund and so forth. So those things with Home Affairs are becoming a bit of a challenge for us, because you know, this is really not so much their core business, and we're trying to get assistance in this respect. Because of the modernization as well, bandwidth is becoming very scarce. You know, we're engaging with Telkom, because what it does is that it slows down the system. You flood the system with information, then it becomes slower. You know, to log on, you know, takes long, to work takes long, to print takes long. So we're trying to increase our bandwidth all the time, you know, using the service providers that are there. The issue of office accommodation, it's a major challenge. It's extremely challenging because we now can't fill posts. We can't create new posts because there's no space, especially in small towns. Again, for argument's sake, in Mpumalanga, we just can't find space. You know, if anybody knows or can find a building or some floors somewhere, even in the CBD, where we can open a master's office, we'd really appreciate it. There's just nothing. We've physically been there. We've looked around. There just isn't. It's not even a question of being over expensive, overpriced. It just does not exist. And it's quite a strange phenomenon in that respect. So it is a bit of a challenge, Chair. But otherwise, we're on top of things as far as this area is concerned. And I'm quite certain that we can give a full report on that, on the figures. I think I'll let the CFO give the specific figures on, in terms of, you know, of millions when he gives his report, just so that it is clear how much we're doing. I must say that use of the service providers has been great. In fact, I think it's what really broke you know, this cycle. Because, you know, they're good at this, they're expert at this, they've brought their people, they're training our people on the system. And because this is what they're good at, their turnaround times are much quicker. and when they're ready now, sort of catching up. So from that from that perspective, Chair, I think we're doing very well. That's all I'd like to present and request maybe questions that I can answer. I just thought I should mention that we have about 4.9 billion under management at the Guardian Fund. That's the amount of money countrywide that is there. So we are we're trying to make sure that we disperse those funds pretty well. You'll recall that a while ago that figure was a bit high, and we kept saying that the higher the figure, the more it reflects that it's not being dispensed with. And I think this is a relatively good decrease because we're spending that money. And in some cases, because of the expenditure, it obviously does get finished, and then we close those files. But it shows a spending pattern, which is good in that respect. So the sooner we're able to decentralize the operations from Pietermaritzburg, the good thing about Pretoria, by the way, is that we opened a Joburg office. So almost half the files in Pretoria moved to Joburg. What it shows you is that, again, we lost an opportunity because for a long time, because it meant that people in Johannesburg had to travel to Pretoria. So by finding a building in Joburg and moving the files there, people no longer have to do that. So it's improved. Now imagine if you can do the same with Polokwane and Mpumalanga, because those people don't have to come to Pretoria. We can move these files back. And then Pretoria will just have files for the Pretoria people. But if you can even move to, let's say, Harangua, we can move to Vryheid, we can move to Richards Bay, we can move to some of these places. We can even do more in that respect. So strategically, those are the things that we're facing. Those are the travel issues that we're facing. There are minor things that I don't think I'd bore the committee with, really management issues, staffing, politics, sign off on travel and so forth. Those ones are under control. They're not a major part of this. But human resource capacity, our main issue. Infrastructure, our main issue, and service delivery from a qualitative standpoint, and expansion of locations from which to give these services is a big point, Chair. So those are three areas, key ones, that the committee can assist us with. In addition to those I mentioned about Operation Isondlo and so forth and so forth. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, DG, for responding to some of the questions we asked yesterday and for briefing us about the Master's Office. Yeah, I'll be lenient because you're sending in for someone else. But I'll request that if we can have that formal presentation so that it be submitted to us, preferably before we go for this debate on the 4th. We really appreciate it. I don't... How much time do you have, DG, with us here, or you have to go somewhere? Because I wanted to engage in a question now so that you respond, that we release you. I think let's deal with it there. Let's deal with it now.
I can stay for all of the questions.
Okay. Yeah, because I don't want to take Cicely in this. She needs her own time, She don't want to be, bogged down by some other issues. She whispered it in my ear. She needs more time. Let me check Honorable Ntuli, Honorable West, Honorable Leroux, Honorable Manyosi in that order. The Master's Office. Over to you, colleagues.
Yeah. Thanks, Chairperson. And I would like to thank the DG for the briefing. You talked about, this thing of who to blame when you visit when you are doing oversight at the provinces. I don't know how to put it, but you are with the department and you ask him why do we have so many vacancies? They'll say, oh, it's national. It's national department. Then you say, but as the manager here, are you not the one who's supposed to make a requisition for a post? They say, no, the national decide. They decide when to give you the personnel. And then it stops there. Now you can't go further than that. They'll just tell you that, oh, we are just here, we are being given. They just tell you this and that. And you fail to understand how can you be a manager if you cannot make a requisition for as a line manager for your department. But they'll just say that, no, it's a national. They give us when they want to. And they decide on the establishment of the post. As a local person, you cannot establish. You have just been given. Maybe we need the clarity there, which is which. And when I go to Master's Court, maybe I have to pull the story because I was also not sure about this, because I went, what do we call this grant where an orphan is being, there is a guardian, what do we call that grant, which being obtained by a person who's looking after the orphan, foster care, yeah, because most of the courts, I mean, or I will say the social welfare, social workers, when a person goes there to say, no, this child, his or her parents passed away, instead of applying for the foster care, they will say, okay, you can apply for the child support. And the child support, it's a very minimal when it compares to foster care. And if you go to the offices, all the social workers, they don't want to go for the foster care because they know that it is going to go to prove this and that. But they'll say, okay, who's the father? And then you find that most of the orphans are getting this child support. And the problem, I think, is the processes. As I was saying, that this person has deceased, so I was going with the grandmother of the child. So, in fact, we're looking for the foster care. They said, no, here you have to go to the master's court where they can be able to see who is the guardian, a constitutional guardian and all that. Then when I went to the master's court, they said they required many documents. I must come with these, the certificates, the siblings and all that they must confirm and all that. But when I came with these documents, I found the other guy. He said, no, Mr. Ntuli, you're not supposed to do this. It is the attorney. You must take these things to the attorney. You're not allowed just to come as a person to look for this foster care and all that and the guardian and all that. Then I said, no, man, but somebody gave me these documents so that I can go around and go get affidavits and all that. But it was just like that. And he said, no, he was misleading you. You must go back and give this to the attorney. We don't deal with that lay person. See? So maybe if you can clarify on that. But there is a big problem. I think it's between the social welfare and the justice. You find the social workers don't want to go to court. They'll just say, sometimes they will say, if you say this kid has got no father, they'll say, no, you must go and look for the father. You say, no, but since he or she was born, he or she has no biologically father known among the family. They'll say, oh, well, we won't be able to help you. You must go and look for this father. then it becomes more difficult when the mother has deceased. Because you've got a record of saying that, no, now you are trying to say, Hambile nai. But they will say, no, look for the father. You say, even the mother did not know the father of this child. They will say, oh, well, we can't help you. That's when I ended up in the master's court and I could not get any help. Maybe you will be able to lead us. Because see, this foster care, even when we are addressing the community, the foster care, it's a new thing, particularly from the black community. Even the master's court, I say, what is that? What is the master's court? And I said, there is an office in Miss Street, along the Smith Street in Durban. And they said, no, what it does? You know, maybe we need this community outreach where we can be able to, but it is difficult even among us because we don't understand exactly what are the functions of the master's court. So I'll stop there, Chairperson. Maybe I hope DG understood what I'm trying to say so that if you can be able to advise accordingly. Thanks.
Thanks, Mpemba. Thanks, Zombies. Honorable West.
Thanks, Chair, and I'd like to thank the GG as well for his presentation here this morning. And then I heard the DG mention the Free State, of course, that's my home province, and there's this big metropolis called Bloemfontein. And last year I went and had a look what was going on at the maintenance court there. And we have the problem that, you see, a lot of the people who get their money, they're paid out in cash at that stage. They show a card and they get the cash. But if you go on the 15th or the end of the month, there's long queues there and they get their money. But those are the fortunate few who the Magistrates Court has managed to get a garnishee order. Now, you get a garnishee order, then those are people, normally people in the state employment or have got steady jobs. Then the money gets deducted and it goes straight in. And where there has been an improvement now is that people have to come from Botshabelo or from Tabanchu, spending a lot of money because transport's expensive to come and get the money. It is being paid into accounts where the people can afford because some of the banks charge to open a savings account or whatever. But the big problem is there are hundreds of others where the ex-father or the husband is unemployed. So you can't get blood out of a stump. So the person gets a job in Bloemfontein, then he's unemployed and he suddenly disappears. And then he goes to work in Welkom, maybe on the mines or whatever, and then that mine closes down and he disappears and he goes to Gauteng to get a job. It's impossible to trace these people, and the files are standing that deep all over, and there's only two maintenance, or there were only two court maintenance officers in charge of this whole process. So we go to these the mothers of these children and we say, "Yuh, what are you doing about it? I mean, the husband, the father of these children has just disappeared. What do you do?" "Oh, no," they say, "it's easy. We get a child grant." They say, "Now, the child grant will help us until the child is 14 years of age, and we hope by the time he gets to the age of 14, it'll have been extended to 18 or whatever." But that is also illegal because you cannot apply through social development for a grant and be receiving, in those cases where it is so happening, even if it's periodically, a maintenance. You cannot do it. Theoretically, it's illegal. But when you ask then Home Affairs or Social Development, do they liaise with Justice, do Justice Department liaise with them, they say no. They say, "We don't know what's going on there, and it seems that there's no communication between the two." Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Honorable West. Yeah, you raised something I was not even noticing. That someone, a child who is getting maintenance can't claim for child support. Okay. Oh, I was not aware of that. Oh, I don't know if people are aware of it. The state is being looted, yeah, I know. Thanks, Honorable West. Honorable Nero.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would also like to thank the DG for giving us an excellent report and explaining things very well. The Guardian Fund, the latest Auditor General's report was very negative on the Guardian Fund and warning us that there are not nearly enough checks to handle a 4 billion rand organization. What's worrying to me is that we now are going to rely on a computerized system, and we say this is going to be better than the manual system. Now, I agree if you have people that are competent and they are fully conversant with a computerized system and they are trained, then obviously that would be the right way to go. I'm just worried that we have not got the capacity now to train so many people in such a short period of time. What does the DG plan to do as far as that's concerned? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Leroux. Can I recognize the Inkosi Mokwayo, the Nekas, Honorable Manyoni?
Thank you, Chairperson. let me start with a question around the Isondlo. I have not really heard the Director General saying something about the sharing of the payment of maintenance. What consideration is given to the fact that the child has a father, biological father, and also has a biological mother? In calculating the Isondlo, what consideration is given to the two parents? Because where they are both working, in terms of the new arrangement, what consideration is given? I've heard you speaking about luxurious cars. I think those luxurious cars you were talking about are luxurious cars of the father's houses. I think those houses were houses of the father's. What about the luxurious cars of the mother and the luxurious houses of the mother? I just want the arrangement around that, the consideration that is being given. To come to the issue, the main issue of the master's office. I'm happy to hear that attention is being given to the fact that functions in some master's offices that have been taken away to other offices, like functions in Amthatha being taken to Grahamstown, and thus rendering the members of the public in Amthatha suffering because of the delays that take place as a result of those functions having taken to Grahamstown. But then, because that has been coming to our constituency office, and I think at some stage I did write to the head office about that complaint. Now, is it the lack of communication, perhaps, of information on the part of the master in the office that they are complaining? And they don't mention the fact that it is because there is no accommodation that these functions were taken away. But they will only say, arbitrarily, the head office took the functions from here to Grahamstown, and giving an impression that functions are still being taken to better places and to better areas and removed from, for example, former homelands as a perpetuation of the deprivation that had always been taking place in terms of service delivery in the past. Is it lack of communication that they are still complaining? Not saying, no, there is no accommodation. I don't know why they don't have accommodation. Ministers in Amthatha had houses, big houses. The president had big offices. I'm not sure why they say they have got no accommodation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Manyos. Honorable Nyanda.
Thank you, Chairperson. It's a worrying issue. It's not a question that Mpumalanga has no space. I'm very worried. because we've got same problems they are raising here, and we don't know where to take these problems. Now, Mpumalanga, it's so big, and we don't have a space for master's office. It's a concern. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Mami Yanda. These questions put.
Chair, if I can start with the content raised by Honorable Unyan. It's actually not, it's not just no space for the master's office. For everything that we want to do, we've really looked. I think in one place we're only able to get floors. We could put 10 people there. We couldn't take that space because it was really not going to be sufficient. I think it's a general challenge of commercial property in most of the very, very small towns. And, you know, we've engaged with Public Works, and they've also really helped look. You know, it's a main one. It's a main challenge. What we're trying to avoid is using mobile units all the time, because I mean it suggests that certain sectors of the community should be serviced through mobile units. But we're looking into it. We're not giving up yet. So we will continue to trace this. But I just thought I should mention, it's not just Mpumalanga only. It's actually all of the small towns. Even in KZN, when you go inland, and we're trying to find these places, it gets very, very hard to find sufficient space. It's the same situation, Honorable Manyosi, in places like Umtata. The reason why the guidance funds were first moved, at the time it was done, the space wasn't the issue. It was the perception that those people are not competent to manage, and people moved to those places. That's why I said earlier, people responded incorrectly, in my view, to challenges that were being raised and questioned. But those offices grew in other areas. And now when we think about moving back the guidance fund, this space is already taken up. So the challenge now is not just about moving back. That we can do now anytime. The problem is, if you move guidance fund back, you then have to move the people that are dealing with guidance fund, or you have to employ people in Umtata that are dealing with guidance fund, but now there isn't space. There's five services that a master's office is offered. It is estate, it is trust, it is the guidance fund, it is curatorships, and insolvency. Those are the only five services that a master's office should offer. Now, as you've indicated, some of them would have all of those except maybe trusts. Trusts, we don't have too much of a problem with. Most of the time, attorneys deal with those matters and banks, so no office has a problem with trust. It's the guidance fund in many cases where you don't find the guidance fund. So we deal largely with the state, administration of the state, appointment of executors and executrixes and all of them, and so forth. But then we'll have a guidance fund in some offices or not have the guidance fund in some offices. So from that perspective, those are the discrepancies you'd see there. But if you go to each master's office and you say, tell me what services you offer here, invariably you find estate, guidance fund, well, in some offices, insolvencies as well. So what we're trying to get at is that each office must be able to offer all five. Trust, I think with time, we possibly won't be dealing with them per office. They'll be dealt with centrally because it's really largely an electronic system. It's not a big one. I'm not worried about trust. The big issue is the state administration of estates, guardian's fund, and so forth. So there we're going to be dealing with them. So on the question by Honorable Manyosi, both are correct. You know, it's a question of space. They have asked, many offices, to their credit, have indicated to National Office that they need space. They've run out of space. And as National Office, that's why I would know. We've looked, we've tried, and we just really haven't found. And we're continuing to try. So if I can throw back a challenge to the Honorable Members, if any of the Honorable Members knows of office space, of people with office space, around your constituencies or in those areas, please let us know and let me know as quickly as possible, because we'll try and get hold of that space In Durban, we're going to solve that problem because, fortunately, Durban being a big city in a way, there's quite a number of that available. So we're negotiating currently with a couple of people that can offer us. But when you start going to Umlazi, you know, a shopping center, we're trying to find floors there to start giving a service, Umlazi and other areas. We're trying to look in Richards Bay. We hope we'll find something. In the Free States, would be happy if we can be assisted, Honorable West. If you know people that own commercial property that can give us land, would be happy to take that up and roll out a service there. So in really in any area where you become aware, because sometimes you know we don't. I try to not put the burden only on the heads of offices because they deal with the day-to-day management of the office. Now to require them to phone around and look for space can be a bit too much. So we try and assist them where we say we know that in your area, here's a company that has land. What we try and do actually is if you take the Star, I don't know where like Cape Agus has this. If you look at the back, you find auction. Sometimes I see that people auction pretty decent buildings. You know, we're able to tell Public Works that please look at that building. It looks like it's being auctioned and we can look at it. And Public Works assist us in doing that. So in the urban areas, other than very small towns, we don't have much of a problem. We're beginning to find a solution, even here in Cape Town. But in small towns, we have a bit of a challenge. And then in the townships and in the rural areas. We've started even looking for land there to speak to municipalities to try and see if municipalities have land. And where they have land, we're trying to negotiate to buy it, and then we can build a big service. On the issue of child grant, Honorable Worth is correct. You either get maintenance or you either get a child grant. Now, the department in the master's offices, we do not offer those services. That's why there would be the confusion that Honorable Nduli faces in the master's office and MLAZ, their court, because we don't do it. And any official that should be attempting to assist to get a child grant, you must know that they shouldn't be doing it. They're doing something wrong. They can only refer you to social development. They can only assist you by telling you what information you need to have with you. But they can't seek to assist you there. They'll be trying to do a fraud, in my view, and that will be dismissible. They can't do it because they'll be doing exactly what Honorable Wright says may be happening, that people, instead of referring you where you can get a child grant, they try and capture your information and put you under the Guardian's Fund. So there's something wrong. You either get maintenance, you either would be receiving money from the Guardian's Fund, and there's a criteria for that, or child grant. And the child grant, that's why you need attorneys, because the papers for foster care must be in order for you to be granted the right to claim. So a foster parent must have papers in order. Papers in order and so forth. So that requires an attorney. So that's why they will do that. But if master's office people are trying to do that, they can't. So those are the only five services that you offer in a master's office. Insolvencies, guardian fund, curatorships, estate, and trust. On the issue of establishment, they are correct, Honorable Nduli, that it is national office that decides what post to create where. And it's because we have to take into account budget considerations. That one is centralized, and I actually make that decision. You know, I require all of the offices to, if they need space, they must send a request to me so that I can interact with that particular need and that particular area and be able to make a decision. Because sometimes, because of budget constraints, we have to make a choice. Same thing with people who want new posts. They'll indicate to say, our workload has grown, we need maintenance investigators, we need maintenance officers and those type of thing. But what I'll then do is I'll take that information and then check with other offices to check what the need is. And the office with the most need is the one that eventually will get the results. So I err on that particular side. And people do know that that is the scenario. We can't give everybody everything that they need. We just don't have that that type of budget. So if there's more money, I've recently made a decision to allocate more resources towards creating court interpreter posts against the other needs. So I've said, look, we're under pressure as far as interpreters are concerned. I'm very sorry. There's only so much money available. all of it is going to go towards these interpreter posts because it's a long-standing problem. So one makes those judgment calls. So they are correct in that respect. What they are not correct about is that if a budget is allocated and posts are allocated and they are vacant, they are the ones that are supposed to then say, I need assistance to fill in these posts. What we've done to even further streamline this is that all of the offices of justice now report via the head of office for justice in a province. So the regional head in Cape Town takes a responsibility for the administrative processes of the masters as well. So if you go to a master's office anywhere and they say we need posts, if you want to check who's accountable, who should be to blame, it's the head of that office and now the regional head of justice in the province. So the head of justice in the province takes charge of the administrative responsibilities in those offices as well, because the HR functions are there in the regional office. So they're supposed to help them also fill in the posts. So we're trying to streamline it in that way, and there are appropriate delegations now. So the issue of somebody not able to fix a light bulb, a globe, those things shouldn't be happening. People have delegations to spend up to a particular amount. I've just increased the delegation to follow the latest treasury guidelines for work to be done without having to go through national office. Anything up to $500,000 can now be done in a specific region. So if somebody wants to buy a fax machine, not one, maybe two, it costs reasonably cheap. These complicated and sophisticated multi-photocopiers, they can cost up to 50, 80,000. If you need to buy 5, 10 of those, you don't have to wait for national office to do that. Nobody can claim that. If you need to fix plumbing, in a court or some structure of a court that's dilapidated, you don't need national office to do that. You can engage directly with public works in a province using the guidelines that national office would have determined, and you can get that done pretty easily. So most of the excuses and explanations that have been given now actually fall away completely. You can ask people to say, but what delegations do you have? And they know the delegations. They can even give you a copy. They're also available if members would like to see those delegations. Then you can ask each person at each office to say, but you have these delegations to do the following. Why can't you do it yourself? At the most, people should be able to say, I just don't have a budget. Then we can check if they really truly don't have a budget or not. In some cases, it may be correct. But in many cases, it's easy to just say it's national office. And it's really just a historical thing. We're paying the price for having centralized all the time, because people were always used to saying, no, check with national office. Now, even if they don't have to, they still say, just check with national office, because that's the framework we followed. Now that you are changing it, it's a bit difficult. Also, it's difficult because people were never required to have these competencies. They were never required because they never had to make the decision. Because it was decided nationally, they were never tested on this competence. Now that they have to do it, people are shocked. They say, no, I can't do this, I can't do that. They say, no, but you're the head of office, you should be able to take all of these decisions. It's a shock all of a sudden. So we have to ease them into that as well, because it is a function that they are really truly now being required to be able to account for when they previously didn't have to. So those are the things that we are dealing with. I just forgot to mention there's four key posts in the post classes in the master's office that the members should be aware of. You have a master of the High Court, which is largely the head of office. We have a deputy master. Small offices would be headed by a deputy master, not a master. Then you have an assistant master. Now, those three post classes are people that are really officers of the High Court. A master is a master of the High Court. If you have somebody deputizing for you or assisting as a master, those are all masters of the High Court at those different levels, assistant master and so forth. So their responsibilities are really to the High Court. That's why we then have decided to employ legal people, because they perform legal functions. What we have to decide going forward is whether we should require them to have a right of appearance, because you can't really be a master of the High Court and not have a right of appearance in the High Court. It doesn't make sense. There must also be that correlating right, so that you must make appearances in the High Court as well to deal with files. So that's why you must understand why we've moved, excuse me, towards the employment of legally qualified people. Then the fourth post is an estate controller. These are people that that really manage files, and there we felt that paralegals there would be useful as well. So we can employ those paralegals. Those are the four sort of core professional posts in a master's office. The rest of the posts are really administrative, clerks, finance people, and so forth. But the people that perform a core of the service are people in those four post classes. So you really also then have to look at it in that way. A master's office is really also just an extension of a law firm, as the deputy minister said, to say it's lawyers that are employed there. So the quality of the service should really reflect that you have you know, properly qualified people. So that's what I thought I should mention, Chair, are things that honourable members should note. The training is a point. It's put on. That has to be really, really ongoing. We're sending a lot of these officials for training, starting with the masters. In fact, I've just sent a couple of senior officials to VET to undergo a specific management program focusing on procurement and PE. Remember that the master's offices appoint liquidators in liquidation. It's important that they're fully aware of what procurement processes and policies are from a management and strategic perspective. It's important that they understand what the BEE legislation says, and VET is offering an executive program over 3 days. So we're sending about 20 of them to go there, and I think get about 5,000-6,000 a pop. So we're really trying to invest, in training for officials. So this is ongoing. It's going to be pressure short to medium term, but in the long run, the benefits should flow in the speed and the quality of the service that is offered. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you very much. There is only one follow-up question, then we wrap up. Honorable Ntuli.
Thanks, Chairperson. No, I think DG, maybe I did not come clear. I just want to check if you are applying for a foster care. I was trying to highlight the problem that instead of applying for a foster care, people tend to apply for a child support. Now, to be specific, where do you apply for the foster care? Thanks.
I'll double check the chair. I think people are supposed to apply at social development. But what they do for the granting of an order that you be a foster parent, you be recognized as a foster parent, you then go to a magistrate court. So that's the only time people can come to court, and that's when these issues of boundaries come in about what jurisdictional area a court operates in. But the filling of forms and all of those things are done with social welfare, in the offices of social welfare, and then people can come to court. That's when you come to court, you must come with your papers ready, your lawyers must be there with you, and both parents or the foster parent must be there with the child. That's what is required when you appear in court. And I think because people appear in court to get an order in that way, people then also think that you must do the applications there in court. So what Honorable Ntuli is raising is maybe a possibility that, you know, we need to possibly work with social welfare to say, if a court is a very close place for purposes of applying and filling in the forms, maybe we should consider seeing how we can have the capacity to just enable people to fill in the forms, you know, because filling in a form and getting the right information is something that government should be able to offer from any location. You know, you can't have officials of government in a court saying, no, we can't help you, it's that department. It's one government after all. So we should be able to at least say, these are the forms you fill, they are available here, you fill them in this way. But then, this is what will be required, and this is where you go for a specific order. I think that's the type of thing we must communicate, but I know, say, that our offices do not engage in applications for foster care and child grants at all. It is social development and social welfare in the provinces.
Good. One other question that I want to ask is that why is only lawyers who must assist these poor kids in terms of the foster
foster care. An ordinary person can't just assist the poor kid if the information is readily available.
Yes, I think it's that issue. You know, it's like, as I was like applying for an ID, to say why should you only find the forms at Home Affairs offices? Because if you can fill a form yourself, all you want is a copy to go and fill at home or something. Maybe those types of things should be available readily at any government office, and then you should be assisted to fill in the form. I think what we can undertake to find further information on is how we can assist and make sure that there's enough information to enable applicants to at least know what is required. I'd imagine that there must be a guardian who's looking after the child who wants to be a foster parent and recognized appropriately. And there must be all of the personal details of that person readily available. And that is the person that must be there. I'd imagine there's also a social worker would have to be there to do an assessment, because when you go to court to get an order, social workers have to be present to say and confirm that they've done a report, they've done an assessment, and the magistrate takes that into account in granting an order. So we'll try and get more information so that we can be clear on this, but it certainly is not us. On the question, I forgot to answer the question Honorable Manyosi raised about the dual responsibility to maintain children. When maintenance is calculated, that is taken into account. So officials do advise applicants that they also have a responsibility. So the challenge then arises usually where the applicant, whether in many cases it's the mother, doesn't work. That really is where the biggest responsibility lies, where the mother doesn't work, and therefore they have nothing to offer. But, you know, what's taken into account is the fact that they live with the child, so they make means to maintain the child to the best they can, unemployed as they may be in some cases. So when the final amount is calculated, it's taken into account. Similarly with those that work, you know, we take into account that this is what they bring on the table, and then, you know, the other person must then also put something on the table to match that. I think the discrepancy always arises in that the parent not living with the child is usually the one that sometimes is seen to be contributing a lot less than the parent living with the child. So that's what we try and balance, to say, you know, at least there must be a recognition that it's a dual responsibility. And in many cases, that is not the biggest problem. The biggest problem is that, you know, whatever the amount, you know, people just want to pay maybe $50. Or 100 rand, and they say that's all I can afford. So it's usually almost the ridiculous nature of the amounts that the other side wants to pay. When on the facts, their lifestyle reflects a lifestyle that suggests that they can do a bit more than what they're offering, and that's usually where the tension lies. And you find that the more people have means, the more they find means of avoiding it. So we find business people that really do everything to hide that they do it, and usually it's a problem between parents. That's why we sort of did not put a step on the pedal around other mechanisms to force people to come forward, because people do become harsher in the way they respond, because we find that between the two parents there's already a very difficult relationship, and we just make it worse by responding to those issues in a harsher way. So we try to bring them together and mediate more than anything else, which then delays matters because people complain about the delay. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, DG. Maybe one for the road. There was this case that they got some on the limelight, where one man was accused, who was supposed to maintain his child, claimed that the paternity was not 100% complete. Said, why is it 99.99 something? He wanted it to be 100%. And I know the case is still even now still pending. And that particular somebody. Yeah, I'm not going to go any further. You know what I'm talking about, commitment. Why is that? Is there any possibility where it can be 100% paternity, that is? And this other person is not there. Why is not that 100%? Now, again, to the question about open tool, it about an ordinary somebody assisting a person. Can you say something about the road accident fund? It was the same thing as well, where it's only lawyers who can do it. Can't mommy and dad assist someone who was involved in an accident there, and maybe the husband passed on, and the relevant documents, can they submit direct to REF, you know, for them to be assisted? Only a lawyer who must, with due respect to another main lawyer in this house, who are, not you, Lindy, who are looting our people, you know, because of their ignorance. Yes, come with me.
No, I think the issue of a paternity test being 100%, I have never come across a case where it has to be, where a test comes and says it's 100%. What the test does, as I understand it, is that it eliminates people. So if it comes and it says that it's 99.2%, it says that the chances are that you are 0.2 chances that you are not the parent. So what you're saying is that the 99% shows that the chances of you not being the father is 1%. So conversely, it says, you know, you are likely therefore to be the father. The technical legal argument is that if therefore it says it's 0.0008 chances that I'm not the parent, then it's possible that I'm not. So on that basis, I'm not going to meet it. It's an unfortunate interpretation. Legally, it's a sound one. That's why it's better to wait for the court to give a judgment and indicate what exactly should be the situation. What it talks to is that maybe the means to getting DNA would have to be enhanced. Right now they use saliva, which is more reliable than blood. Maybe going forward there must be tissue sampling maybe to use. But it just talks to the questioning of a science used to check DNA. So I think the courts will resolve those in a progressive manner, so that matter will be resolved. Just regrettable that it's a reason in that type of environment. The question of assisting people other than lawyers, again, you know, I think it's something to engage with the relevant department. I think the reason why it is generally understood to be attorneys that should do it is that the appearance in court is a legal matter. You know, you appear with lawyers and so forth. It should be possible. I fail to believe that if parties have done the forms well, a social worker is there, and there's a favorable report from a social worker, or even any report from a social worker, the matter will not be heard solely because of absence of a lawyer. It's unlikely to me. I think generally, because it requires going to court, we've tended to say let lawyers be there. And I think those issues can be clarified to say you don't need a lawyer. I definitely know for maintenance matters, you don't need a lawyer to appear. If the officials assisting at least are good enough to give you that far. But we'll check all of that information and see what can be done. Thank you.
On that note, I think we can wrap up this discussion here about the master's office. And thanks, DG, for the information that will assist us really in preparing our speeches for that day. At least we know who to blame for not filling vacant posts. Thanks very much for that. That's the key one. Thank you very much. No, I think a colleague said we are done for this one. I think we can happily now invite Usus Lindy to talk to us now. We are now in litigation. We are going to litigate now. Yeah. Thanks, DG. Colleagues, can we now take a presentation from litigation unit by Advocate Lindy? Quite well, Tom.
Thank you, Chairperson, honorable members, for the opportunity. I must say, Chairperson, I have a challenge that, you know, there are questions that have been asked not directly relating to my work, which I'm very much tempted to try and put more information for the consumption of the members on, but at the same time, I don't want those issues to start clouding my own presentation and shift the focus from what the business of the litigation unit is about. Can I ask for your guidance on that one? But I think it's issues relating to paternity. I had hoped that DG would stay just 2 minutes longer. Paternity and road accident fund issues, and basically the question as to why it becomes necessary for lawyers to get involved in assisting people to access services that they are legally entitled to. I think it's important to draw a line between just the completion, accessing services by simply completing forms. Like if you apply for an ID, you don't really require legal advice on how to complete the forms. But there are instances where, over and above just completing the forms, you also need to make out a case. For example, with road accident fund issues, you've got to make out a case of the extent of your injuries, how, and there are calculations that are done that lawyers are best placed to do those calculations. So I think it's important to draw the line on those issues. But there are instances where people use lawyers where it is really not necessary. All that is required is just filling in forms and submitting the forms, and then you can access the service readily. On issues of paternity, I must say, I think it was very brave of the DG to try and answer issues of paternity, because it's more of a science than legal, as to, you know, how do you determine paternity. It's doctors who can tell you, and the degrees of probability of one being a father and not being a father. So I wouldn't really attempt to answer. And on that note, I wouldn't really be best placed to answer the question that was asked yesterday. Chairperson indicated expected of me to respond to on how many fathers out there maintaining kids that are not biologically there. I think that's the best I can do on that question. With your permission, Chairperson, I would proceed onto my presentation. Members would realize that there should be 4 documents that have been put before members on litigation. There is the one which says presentation to the select committee. It's on the screen as well. That is the main presentation. And then there is also, and that is the document that I'll start with. And then there are 2 documents on political pardons. The one says briefing notes on the reference group. That is a very elaborate report which I think members can read at their own leisure, but I've tried to summarize that document and presented that in the document called Summary of Briefing Notes on Political Pardons, to facilitate easy access to the documents. I would advise that the briefing notes document be set as put aside and members can read at their leisure. And then there's also one that says progress report on departmental APEX priorities. That is the last document I will talk to. And that is really a highlight of what we have prioritized on the challenges that would come out of the first document. So I'll start with the main document, the presentation itself. Chairperson and honorable members may recall that in my maiden presentation to the select committee last year, I alluded to challenges that the branch, but mainly the state attorney's offices have. And the first on the list was the poor image for the branch. So I'll just rehash those challenges and then talk to what interventions have been put in place just to create a fuller picture of the progress that has been done so far. So the one challenge was the poor image of the branch, and this was articulated to lack of resources, inadequate skills, poor case management, public relations issues. The second one was a weak relationship management, which emanates from inadequate or no instructions from client departments to the state attorneys, poor communication with stakeholders, the misunderstanding by client departments of attorney and client relationship, lack of professionalism. I'll just go into specifics on the two main ones. In as far as the lack of resources are concerned, members may also be aware of a case that served before the Constitutional Court last year, where the state attorney filed, that is the Pretoria state attorney, filed an affidavit saying, among other things, causes of the poor service rendered by the office related to the lack of resources. Now, on that specific issue, we have then dedicated the management efforts into addressing issues of a lack of resources. And I can report today, you'll see when we get to the apex priorities, that an amount of about 5 million rand, an additional allocation of about 5 million rand was made to the state attorney's offices last year to address the issue of lack of resources. But what has also come out as we went on that exercise, and I must say we were helped to a very large extent by the Office of the Chief Financial Officer, specifically Johan sitting with us here. What also we identified was that managers tended to think that if you have an allocation within your budget, then you are only limited. For example, if you have an allocation for goods and services and you have exhausted that allocation and you still have an allocation on another item, you can't tap into that item if you have savings on that. So it was more issues of financial management as well. And with the assistance of the CFO's office, we were able to shift funds where it was necessary and legally permissible to do so, to make sure that they have more resources. And then on inadequate skills, we will be having a skills audit, a fully-fledged skills audit, which will look into what it is that what skills are lacking, and have a plan that will address those skills. We have a partnership with a Justice College. Unfortunately, we could not move with speed on that particular aspect because of the change in the office of the head of the Justice College. But it's a program that we will still be continuing with the acting head at the moment. Issues of poor case management, those are instances where you find that, and also I'd make reference to pronouncements that have been made by the Constitutional Court and also the Pretoria High Court on the poor management of cases by some of the attorneys in the state attorneys' offices, where you found that in some instances they would receive papers and take too long to inform the government parties about that particular case. Let's say, for example, if the Minister of Justice is sued, the papers that are served on the Office of the State Attorney and the State Attorney's Office would take long to inform the department, and therefore there would be no instructions. And then, as members would know, that litigation is very much tight on time frames, then you'd find that you get judgment against a minister when the minister is not even aware that there's a case against them. So those are the type of problems that we've come across. And then generally, because of those negative reports that have been going on in the media and also within the government circles, the image, public relations was also an issue, because the image, the message that was going out there was that there is no service worthy of mention that is provided properly by the state attorney's offices. I will go on to, I've spoken to the weak relationship management. And then we also have litigation-specific challenges. And under the litigation-specific challenges, in other words, challenges that relate to litigation outside management and all those issues, one of the key contributors to these challenges is that we're experiencing that our society is becoming highly litigious. We have higher incidences of matters being taken to court than it ever happened in the past. And the main departments which are experiencing these large increases in litigation are Home Affairs, the Department of Health, Correctional Services, issues that cut across all the departments on procurement procedures, mainly issues emanating from tendering for government services, matters relating to compliance with PAJA, labor matters, SAPS and or Department of Justice, and specifically on SAPS and the Department of Justice, cases dealing relating to unlawful detentions, unlawful arrests, and malicious prosecutions. And then we have also on the increased constitutional challenges. We have a case which was argued in the Constitutional Court last year, and we're still awaiting judgment on that one, where the State Liability Act, an application was made to have specifically Section 3 of the State Liability Act being declared unconstitutional. So those are the areas where we have a high increase in the litigious society. The second one would relate to opportunistic, what we refer to as opportunistic litigation. I prefer to speak to that one when we deal with the APEX priorities, because that is one of the priority areas that we are dealing with, because it involves a lot of money and it's high volumes of litigation on that one. What we have done in addressing the challenges on issues of capacity, as I've already indicated, we on physical resources, we've made additional allocations, and we'll continuously put on more resources available for the improvement of resources. And I've already spoken to the skills audit and skills development plans that are in the pipeline of being developed. But most importantly, what people know as work study, but what the unit is called DPI in the Department of Justice. We ask them to do an exercise to audit all the state attorney's offices to check on their human resource capacity requirements. And they have done that study and they have made recommendations, and the recommendations are in the process of being considered for approval within the department. And the allocation, the recommendations that they have made, I've just included the recommendations just to give a sense of the need that has been identified by that particular process, so that members would have a better sense of why it is that we've been saying there's inadequate capacity. For the Bloemfontein office, they recommended 30. Maybe let me talk to the high numbers. If you look at Johannesburg and Pretoria, Johannesburg, they've identified that over and above the existing staff establishment, you need 39 new posts. And for the Pretoria office, you need 52 new posts. So those are the highest numbers that are required. And these posts are both professional and administrative, although in many instances you find that it will be more on administrative posts because there hasn't been adequate capacity provided to the state attorney's office to an extent that you find that an attorney does not have a secretary, for example. If you understand how government works, secretary posts are allocated to certain posts within the government structure, for example, from director upwards. Now, if you apply that in the office of the state attorney, you would have assistant state attorneys and senior assistant state attorneys. Those fall below the director level, and therefore, in terms of the norms of government, they are not entitled to have a secretary post allocated to them. The result is that then incumbents in those posts are then left to themselves to see to not only the professional services that they need to provide, but they also have to do their own photocopying, for example, sending out faxes, those administrative things. So that is why there's an increase in the allocation of posts that needs to be made to these offices, so that administrative capacity is beefed up to enable the attorneys to focus on the professional work. And then also there's an office that was the office in Bisho had. In the past, there was a state attorney's office in Umtata, and the report that I have is that office was closed because there were challenges relating to mismanagement. So that office was closed, and the workload then went to the Bisho office, and it strained the Bisho office because then it served both the former Transkei and the former Ciskei area, which is quite a vast area. The result was a drain on mainly on the financial resources because either the Bisho office would use a lot of correspondent attorneys to do court appearances, or attorneys would travel long distances to get to the various courts in order to attend to matters. So we are now in the process of reopening the branch office of the Bisho State Attorney's Office in Umtata. To beef up capacity, we've also expanded on the intensive program that has been rolled out by the department. And under that internship program, there are three categories of posts that we have tapped into, and the purpose is both to contribute towards skills development in the country by taking in unemployed graduates who do not have experience and therefore are unable to get jobs. So we take them into the system, they get the exposure, but in return they also provide a service to the offices. Now, under the intensive programs, we have candidate attorneys, additional allocations that have been made to the offices. There's a list there, and for legal secretaries, that is another category of posts that have been allocated to the state attorney's offices. Now, we have left it to the heads of offices to decide whether they will create a pool of secretaries that will serve the entire offices, or they would allocate secretaries to a number of attorneys. And then we've also tapped into the paralegal program, where we are also taking on paralegals to assist the attorneys to be able to concentrate mainly on the professional service. So those posts have also been introduced. That was in as far as capacity is concerned. One other challenge that we had was because there are inadequate policies, and we are in the process of developing what we call a state litigation blueprint. This is a policy document that we will be presenting to client departments and also to cabinet. And with that policy document, we hope to address issues relating to for example, a litigation risk analysis that has to be conducted on a regular basis, so that we are able to identify what matters expose the state to more litigation, so that we can address those. We will address issues relating to capacity within the departments themselves to deal with legal issues outside of the state attorney's offices. Issues relating to the issuing of the outsourcing of work to private practitioners. So those are issues that will be addressed in the blueprint. I've already spoken to the litigation risk analysis that is going to be conducted, so that we are able to identify. For example, if we have an increase, as we have at the moment, in cases that are brought against the Department of Home Affairs, for example, we should know what it is that exposes the Department of Home Affairs to that escalation in litigation, so that we are able to address those issues and to bring down the level of risk in that area. And also with regards to non-compliance with PAJA, we have a partnership that we have established with the Division of Constitutional Development within the department to ensure that the departments comply to a much greater extent with the prescripts or requirements of PAJA, to an extent that will impact positively not only on service delivery but also on the amount of matters which are brought against the state on the basis of non-compliance with PAJA, because PAJA is one of the risk factors that even outside the formal studies of doing a risk analysis, we've already identified that most of the matters that are brought, for example, against home affairs and social development, they relate mainly to non-compliance with PAJA. Challenges relating to poor or weak relationship management, what we have done to work on that is that we will be having a national state litigation management conference in June, and we want to have this kind of conference annually. In that conference, all the client departments and all the state attorney's offices will come together, so that we talk to all the difficulties that are experienced by both the state attorneys and the clients the management of litigation issues, so that we start strengthening relationship between the two. We'll also be establishing, and that will be arising out of that same conference, a state litigation management forum, a forum where the client departments and the state attorneys would be able to interact on a regular basis on litigation matters, so that if there's a trend that is picked up, for example, on escalation, it should be easy to interact between the state attorneys and the client departments on picking up on those trends and addressing those trends as soon as they pick them up. Most importantly, we will be concluding service level agreements with a client department. And the reason why we want service level agreements is to ensure that issues of, for example, you'd have difficulties between state attorneys and client departments, the one side blaming the other with regard to instructions. So the service level agreement will determine what the responsibilities of each party is and what recourse is available. Just to give an example, if a state attorney is handling a matter for a government department and the government department continuously fails to give sufficient instructions to the state attorney to enable the state attorney to represent the client department in court, then the state attorney should have a recourse in the sense of giving notice to the client to the client department that in the absence of instructions we will we formally withdraw as your attorneys of record, so that the client department will have to see. It would be an unfortunate thing, but it's something that we need to tie both the client department and the state attorneys to, so that they become aware of the implications and there are remedies available in the event of non-compliance by any of the parties. In addressing issues of communication, in many instances you'd find that, for example, And this may also have to do with the fact that in government general, you have a high staff turnover. So, and you find that there's a new person in a department, deals with litigation, papers are saved, they don't know who to speak to. So we have also compiled a directory of all state officials at all levels that we are servicing, that is national level as well as provincial level, a directory of all officials who deal with litigation. And that directory is going to be distributed at the conference and throughout government, the two levels of government that we are servicing, so that communication between the parties is easy. All right. I will then talk to statistics. We have summarized the statistics for the 2006-2007, and I feel that is one of the issues that the chairperson is more interested in. For 2006-2007 financial year, there was an expenditure of 270 million on litigation, over 270 million on litigation, and the highest spender, in as far as that bill is concerned, we have right at the top a SAPS, 31 million, and then SAPS 22 million, the NDPP, the 17 million, DPSA, 10 million. We have departments that account for about 1% of this total amount. I think the lowest figure is about 600 and something thousand, less than a million. But of note is that in 2006-2007, the Eastern Cape, if we go to the next page, that is the breakdown on province level, the Eastern Cape is the highest spender. They spent 52.7 million on litigation, and of that figure, 30 million accounted for the Department of Welfare, and that is the litigation relating to access to welfare grants, the various welfare grants. Now, in the 2007-2008 financial year, we are still in the process of consolidating the statistics. By the time we go for the budget speech, those statistics should be available. And as soon as we have them available, we send them through to the select committee. But in the first quarter, 2007-2008, we spent 60 million. The second quarter, it was 51 million. The third quarter, 66 million. So in total, excluding the fourth quarter, which is still being consolidated together with the annual figures. In the first three quarters, the bill comes to about 177 million for the three quarters. Okay, that is the issues on litigation itself. The other business of the Office of the Chief Litigation Officer relates to patents. Now, members would be aware that currently there is a special dispensation which the President announced in the joint sitting of Parliament in November last year. And that special dispensation is for the consideration of what have been termed political pardons. In other words, applications for pardons by persons who allege that they committed the offences that they've been found guilty of in pursuit of particular political objectives. I consider it necessary to report to the Select Committee on this process because it is ongoing and it is quite a topical. Now, I've indicated that I'll just talk to the summary on this. So I've already indicated that an announcement was made by the President in November about the special dispensation. And the period that was earmarked for this special dispensation was from 15 January 2000 this year up to the 15th of April. Members might be aware announcements were made on radio and in other media that the period has been extended up to the 31st of this month. And that period was extended on the request of what we refer to as the reference group, which is a multi-party task team that has been set up in line with the announcement of the President to assist with the processing of those political pardons. So they made a request to the President to extend that period. And the motivation that they gave was that most of the activities relating to that special dispensation that started within the window period that has been announced. So therefore, that extension was warranted and it was granted. So currently, the multi-party reference group, or what we shortly refer to as the RG, is busy with the processing of the of those applications for the special dispensation. I can report that they are sitting as we speak. They started the session for this month started on Monday, and the department is providing a secretarial support to that reference group, secretarial as well as financial support to the reference group. To date, 940, that is by last week Friday, 940 applications for pardon have been received and they are currently being processed. The reference group requested to meet the President because they had issues that they wanted to raise to the President. Most of those issues related to the terms of reference that have been set up by the President under which they are to perform their functions. And the issues that they raised related, for example, to questions of the disqualification. Members would remember that when the President made the announcement in Parliament, he indicated categories of persons who, convicts or offenders, who would be disqualified from participating in the special dispensation. And among those categories are persons who had applied for amnesty in terms of the TRC regime and who were denied amnesty. Now, this issue has been raised by the reference group and the President was engaged on that. And the proposal that was made was that disqualification should be done away with, should be removed. And another proposal related to accommodating people who have not yet been convicted. It could be people who are still in court but have not yet been found guilty. To qualify for a pardon, you can only be pardoned if you have been found guilty. So if you are still in court and you have not been found guilty, then you can't apply for a pardon. So that issue has been raised by the reference group that these people, if they are then convicted after the close of the window period, then they would not be able to still make use of the special dispensation, and that would disadvantage them. A category of persons who have not yet been charged. Members would know that, for example, the post-TRC litigation unit is dealing with the bringing charges against persons who have either not gone through the TRC process or who have gone through the TRC process applying for amnesty but were not granted amnesty and therefore are still liable to be charged criminally. The proposal that have been made was that provision should also be made to accommodate such people, that if they are prosecuted and found guilty, then they should be considered, they should be able to make use of the special dispensation. Now, on those proposals that were made, it was resolved that with regard to people who have not yet been convicted, whether because they are still not yet charged or they are still undergoing those process, it was decided that it was resolved that a legal opinion would be obtained to assess how best, whether it is feasible to make provision for such people currently, and if so, what kind of provision would be made for them. On the issue of removing the disqualification on people who have been disqualified because they were denied amnesty by the TRC, it was resolved that this matter would best be dealt with by Parliament. So at some stage, it's going to be referred to Parliament for a debate, and a resolution will be taken to Parliament. I can also just mention in passing that on administrative issues, the reference group also raised issues relating to remuneration of the members of the reference group, specifically or particularly those members who are not members of Parliament, because when the President made that announcement, he left it to the party to decide whether the representative that they will send to serve on the multi-party reference group would be a member of Parliament or a non-member of Parliament. Now, for those who are non-members of Parliament, when they attend to the business of the reference group, they take leave from their employer, and therefore there are adverse financial implications on their side. So submissions were made for consideration of remunerating specifically those kind of matters. And the President mandated the Director General in the Presidency to deal with that issue. But we are working on recommendations that we'll be making to the Presidency, particularly given that the budget would come from the Department of Justice. Those are issues relating to political parties. Then I can just quickly talk to, I've spoken to the challenges that we have, quickly talk to what we have prioritized in as far as addressing all the challenges. I think Minister has not informed the select committee that the department has set up what is called the strategic network, which focuses on prioritizing the most problematic areas and setting up a program of dealing with those matters expeditiously. Through that process, we have been asked to prioritize those problematic areas so that we accelerate on resolving those issues. Now, for our office or our branch, the apex priorities related to one on issues of building capacity, rolling out the internship program. I've already reported that we've rolled out that program. The positions of legal assistants or paralegals, legal secretaries, and candidates attorneys, those positions have already been advertised. We are in the process of filling the posts. So the needs were identified, the numbers required by each office were identified, and those posts were advertised, and we're in the process of filling those posts. The issues about the signing of service level agreements, I've already reported that in the conference that we will be having in June, one of the outcomes of that conference is that we will be signing service level agreements. Initially, we had committed to delivering, I'm sure members would have a question as to why we're only doing it in June when in our commitment we said we'll do it in March. Initially, we had put a target of March, And we had envisaged that would be between officials, and the signing would be between the head of a department and the state attorney of a particular office, the head of a particular state attorney office. But then at the political level, it was felt that we need to escalate that to the cabinet, so that cabinet knows and sanctions the signing of service level agreement, so that if there are defaults or if there are problems or if there are achievements, then cabinet would be alive to those and do the necessary interventions. So, and that is what then pushed the signing to June. So the draft service level agreements are already there. What is awaited is for cabinet, and the cabinet memorandum has been submitted to cabinet. It will serve on the cabinet committee before the cabinet committee next week on Tuesday. The establishment of a litigation management forum with stakeholders. The litigation management forum, a draft constitution is already there. The forum will be established formally. The establishment will be debated on, and formally we expect that one of the outcomes of the conference is that forum will be formally launched in the conference in June. That conference is going to take place from the 11th to the 13th of June. Invitations should be coming shortly to the select committee as well on that one. The development of a blueprint, I've already alluded to why we need to have a blueprint on state litigation. We have already started on that policy document. It's work in progress. But the final draft will be presented to the conference for further input, and then it will be sent to cabinet. We're targeting July for consideration of that blueprint, and we hope that by the end of July that policy would have been considered and approved by cabinet. I've already alluded to also the directory of officials dealing with litigation at national and provincial government levels. The directory has already been compiled. It is just awaiting the communication section in our department is busy with formatting it and doing the layout for printing. And then we've also I've indicated to members that we've seen an increase in litigation in certain areas. One of the areas was litigation against the Department of Home Affairs, particularly the highest numbers are in KwaZulu-Natal. So we established an interdepartmental task team to deal specifically with that litigation. And arising out of that task team, what we have done is we've identified where the sources of the problems are, and the sources of the problems were, apart from the fact that we have very high volumes of matters which are brought against the department. I can mention to members, and this was also in the newspapers, but although it was newspapers that circulate in KwaZulu-Natal, the Mercury specifically. A judge had commented that there are attorneys who are bringing high volumes of litigation against the Department of Home Affairs. And when the judge did an analysis of the matters that are brought, he identified a lot of deficiencies in the applications themselves, which gave a sense that, it's a business that is run by the attorneys, and they do not attend to the specific details of these applications, and as a result, the court role is blocked because we have very high volumes of matters which are brought against the department. Now, on the side of managing that litigation, because of the high volumes, the state attorney's office had difficulties in dealing with it. But what we have put in place to to address the problems was that we have now linked the system, what we call the SAP system. It's an electronic system which records matters for the state attorneys. We have linked it to the Department of Home Affairs so that when the state attorney receives the application brought against Home Affairs, when they capture that application on their system, automatically that report is sent to the Department of Home Affairs. And therefore, Department of Home Affairs would immediately become aware of that particular case, and then they can start working on details of that, identifying, looking at the application that has been brought, what the issues are, who is the applicant, checking the status of the application. Most of these applications against Home Affairs are relate to applications for ID documents. So you find that somebody has applied for an ID document, Home Affairs takes long in delivering the ID document to the applicant, and in the interim, the lawyer will then advise the applicant to lodge an application, a health court application against the department. So, in many instances, the Department of Home Affairs had made use of the post office to deliver the applications, and that relationship had its own problems. So, in some instances, you find that the IDs have been produced by the department, but they are lying somewhere in the post offices, still not being delivered to the applicant. So when the system reports to Home Affairs that you have an application by Mr. X, they would be able to go into their own system immediately and check how far that application of Mr. X is, and then give instructions to the state attorney. So the result is that there is no longer a difference of time between the capturing of the information and communicating that specific application to Home Affairs. Previously, the state attorney's office would receive, capture on their system, scan the application, and then only after scanning the application, then send the application to Home Affairs. You would have a difference of about 2 to almost a week time difference between that communication getting to Home Affairs, so that they then start working on the instructions, and that time lag created problems. So that is the system that we have put in place. We have also the state attorney's office, together with Home Affairs, also engaged the attorneys, and the arrangement that they had between themselves and the attorneys was that the attorneys would provide a list of all the applicants that they are representing, who have already launched applications against the department, and they would give Home Affairs 30 to 45 days to go into the system to check on the status of the applications, and then inform the attorneys what the status is. Where the ID has already been issued, they would indicate ID has been issued, applicant should go to this particular point to collect the ID. The result was that then it was agreed that while that process is unfolding, the attorneys would not proceed to put the matters on the roll for arguing in court. So we were able to delay the escalation of those applications to go onto the court roll. So time has been given for the matter to be resolved out of court, because if an application has been lodged and you find that the ID has already been produced, it's just a matter of saying to the attorneys, your applicant application for ID has been processed, positive outcome, the ID is at this point, applicant should go. Then there is no longer any need for the matter to go to court. We're hoping that this intervention will assist in reducing the load of matters which are still pending against Home Affairs relating to this application. So with the success of this program, We will learn from how effective that kind of an intervention is, and then we are looking at rolling it out to other sectors where there is an escalation or high incidence of litigation against the department. And then on training, I've already indicated that the Justice College will be our partner in providing training to attorneys. But also over and above that, we have Advocate Hussein who has been employed by the department and who's currently also providing training to state attorneys on management of litigation. Lastly, on our APEC priorities is the implementation of an outreach program. Having identified that the general public is not aware, either not aware of the services that we are rendering or are not aware of how to access those services, specifically relating to pardons, but also applications that are brought in terms of Section 327 of the Criminal Procedure Act. Those are applications to refer the matter where a judgment has already been given and all the processes have been exhausted. In other words, where either the person who's been found guilty in a criminal court has exhausted all the appeal processes and they're no longer, or those processes are no longer available and new evidence comes about, then Section 327 of the Criminal Procedure Act makes provision for an application to be made to reopen that case for that new evidence to be laid in court. We've noticed that, you know, members of the public are not aware of this kind of a service. So we will be embarking on an outreach program of where we will be disseminating information to the general public. In as far as pardons are concerned, we started with the special dispensation because it is ongoing and it has a limited time frame. So on that, we had a number of radio shows. We were allocated slots mainly in the current affairs programs of various radio stations, and we gave that kind of information. We also featured on the SABC choose a view from the house. Information about the special dispensation is also available on the Justice website. Forms are available in the Magistrates Court. So information has been disseminated and we have received positive outreach. But I must also say something that is not mentioned in the document is that we also partnered with Correctional Services to assist us in disseminating information, particularly given the fact that most of the political convicts are still in prison, and that partnership has also worked very well. That will be my presentation. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ms. Lindy. Maybe let me be formal, Advocate Viragans. Colleagues, without any waste of time, can I open the floor for questions? Honorable Manyosi, Honorable Ndoli, Honorable Nyanda, in that order.
Thank you, Chair. Let me be formal and say I thank Advocate Vilakazi for the presentation. It has been a good one and extensive one. Now, comrade, you, Advocate Vilakazi, has alluded to the Eastern Cape high spending on litigation, which I completely agree with her on that one. And attaching perceptions, if they are perceptions, that there are allegations that government loses cases due to it, employing lawyers that have failed in private practice. That has always been a grumbling in the Eastern Cape.
that lawyers that are employed there, in one way or another, they have failed in private practice, and it is easier to be employed in the state attorney's office. Now, how severe is that, or how true is that? But then I'm coming from the Eastern Cape. Those allegations seem to me to be a genuine allegation. The second one is, there is also the issue that allocating of cases to attorneys, private attorneys, is done on a preferred basis to attorneys that are preferred, to the exclusion of others, not on the basis of efficiency of their law firms by the Office of the State Attorney, not on the basis of the efficiency of that law firm, but other kickback considerations. Now, what is the view of the Office of the State Attorney to that allegation? Also, Advocate Vilakazi has said that the Mthatha office was closed due to mismanagement. Was that the only way to solve that problem, where there is mismanagement? I take it that there are other remedies for that rather than saying we are closing this office because these people here are inefficient. If there is mismanagement, it means inefficiency. Now, the question of severance of relationship between the state attorney's office and client department on grounds of non-cooperation or poor instructions. What processes are followed in doing so? Because the state attorney's office is a government office, and the department is a government office. It normally happens with private practices that they will abandon a case on the grounds that the instructions that they are given are poor. It's easy there because it's a private firm serving a client. The other one is for clarity now. The political pardons. I know most of these people are people related to the TRC, but my question of clarity is, are these all people that committed the offenses before 1994, or some of them after 1994? That is my last question. Thank you.
That was Wagman Yossi for his reference. Honorable Ntuli?
Yeah, thanks, Chairperson. And would like to thank the Advocate Vilakazi. I'm a bit puzzled. I'm not sure whether this litigation the Office of the Chief Litigation Office, is it a new thing? If you look at the presentation, they are still going to do this, they are going to do this. It seems as if it's a vision, or that's what you think to do in the future. We don't see what we have done. And you mentioned, you said the recommended additional post. I want to find out this, if you say recommended additional post, are they funded? Because we are being told whenever the department, they will say, no, the posts are not funded. So it means then if you talk about the additional recommended, if they are not funded, they are good as they are not existing. Now I'm to find out when you say recommend, are they funded? And you are talking about PAJA. I'm sorry, I'm a slow learner. Sometimes if you abbreviate, I don't know what is this PAJA. Now you continue PAJA. Well, what is it? And you know, we've got a shocking information about the department not complying. The department's not complying to anything which is being said, like the Public Service Commission. And here, you talk about the litigation against the department and the department not responding to the attorney. Now, if you look at that, who pays? Let's say if the department or the minister is not responding to the state attorney about the information which his or her department is litigated, then let's say if the department is being sued, who pays? How does the minister affected or the relevant department affected when that money is paid? Because I'm thinking that some of these things they don't pay because, after all, the government will pay. Then there's nothing. There are no consequences or mechanism of making that particular department suffer because they did not reply in time or they did not comply. So I want to find out what are the mechanism of punishing that department which did not give information which was required by the state attorney. Lastly, is this pardon, this reference group which I say they want to be paid. Why should the Department of Justice pay those people? Because these are political initiatives. The political parties do get money for being political parties in parliament, and there are allocations of money given to them. Now, if a person is going to be there for his party, because this thing is political, you find that the PAC will say, we want to get our people out, IFP and ANC, whoever. Now, the department must pay for that. Because here, the political party is using its or her own people. These people who are called the reference group. Now, why should the department pay? Thanks.
Thanks, Honorable Ntuli. Can I call on Honorable Nyanda?
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is a concern. Home Affairs officially committed themselves fully to deliver on all IDs that are due to interns. I don't know whether is it going to be a new Home Affairs or the very same one that we know, because there are people who applied for 3 to 4 years until up to now they never get their IDs. I don't know. Maybe it's another Home Affairs. In my area, in Mpumalanga, we end up asking the mobile unit to come and service these people. The very same mobile unit, people are still waiting for their IDs until up to now. I don't know, maybe it's another Home Affairs, because this one is too problematic. My other question, Chairperson, internally, documents on the processes are either being reversed or still to be developed. How long is it going to take? Well, after information of material will be distributed. And my other question is that you are saying you've been to media, publicity, TV. Our people, some of them, they don't even have this TV. They can't read, they can't write. Have you ever, you and Correctional Service, went outside calling Bezos,
and explain to the people so that they must understand. I don't know. Maybe you'll answer me. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Let me check my two colleagues at the back. Any questions? No. Right. Few easy questions from this side, simple ones. Let's start with the lack of professionalism by people who are supposed to deliver service to our people. What measures have been put in place to correct this lack of professionalism? Simple. The second one. Now, this culprits department, culprits, what are you going to do, including your own department, because it's also a culprit, in terms of litigation? What are you going to do to jack up or assist them, or to whip them, or to make them aware that some of their behaviors, we might not tolerate them any further, including Justice Department? Justice Department as well. They are also a culprit. What are they going to do? Now, I suspect you have outsourced some of the work to private firms, as it was said. Can I get a percentage of the outsourced work in terms of percentage, and how much are we paying for that, for the outsourced work rather than using our own people? Let me thank you for having done such a wonderful job in terms of giving the quarterly expenses, even to itemize them per province. That's dynamic. On that one, we have outshined even your other colleagues who appeared before the committee yesterday. Congratulations. But the look from your colleagues at the back is not nice, I must tell you. Now, I'm trying to check in your own analysis and research. I know some didn't prepare their cases thoroughly. Poor case management, and they couldn't make the necessary follow-ups. We've been lambasted as the government of losing cases left and right. Losing cases unnecessarily. What could be a problem? I know I wanted to talk to the state law advisor this afternoon, but on litigation, we're losing cases here, madam, and it beats me. I can't understand why. Now, in terms of people who are representing us, Madam Villagas, which are the worst performing legal reps who are messing us up as a state? Want to name and shame today. The worst performing, because they want to make sure that those people really, they don't get anything from us, because really, we can't continue to use them while we're losing cases when we're represented by them. Which are the worst performing ones here? Now, can I sue if I did not get and employment, or I was unable to access a service in a particular department because Home Affairs didn't give me my ID. I don't know what number is the question. Flowing from that, if I'm faster, stop me, Madam Vinegas. Okay, good, wonderful. I know you're a star, when, but me, I'm the moon. Right. Now, to have an ID, is it a right or a privilege? I can't motivate them. Now, there is this much money that we are paying because some department. This is a follow up to a question by Honorable Ndul. The kind of money that we are paying because we can't comply with court orders, because I know many departments that they don't comply to court orders deliberately. I want us to name and shame those departments and to get reasons why they did not comply, and to get names of those who are representing us who could advise our departments expeditiously so that we're not embarrassed. Now, the shifting of funds, where you said that now, from now onwards, we'll be able to shift funds from this line item to the other line item. I wonder if that will be permissible. Because if a fund is earmarked for something, I don't think you can just willy-nilly shift it to another line item, to another program. There must be some processes, but can you educate us as to how do you want to do that? Because I know Treasury, in municipalities, in some other provinces, when they were told that there were many culprits who were just out of the blue, if especially during December, January, February, during the fiscal dumping, the dumping period, they would shift money from one program to another program just to justify their expenditure. Tell us, how do you want to do it? Shifting of funds, as you just said. There about to be the principle for some of our officers, the attitude by our people in these offices. How often do you engage Public Service Commission or SAMD to try to come and just instill some discipline, or try to motivate our officials to practice this thing that's simple that we call what to be the principle? When I look at the litigation, I can't even quote this amount. 270 million. Is it 270 million or what? It's billion. Oh my goodness.
No, it's million.
Million. 270 million. 270 million. 187,274.04. Ah! I managed. Now, let's go to pardon. Let's go to the pardons. No, but let me leave this thing. Now, let me leave this thing, the pardons. I think Honorable Julie and Mayusi dealt with it. Let me leave it. Maybe when we do our follow-up questions, we might come back to it. For now, this will be the only questions Advocate Vilagazi, Seswam Lindi. I think what we're going to do, I don't think I'll be unfair to you. I won't ask you to respond now. I want you to relax, sit back, relax, and just go and enjoy our lunch. You'll respond when you come back at 14 hours. Because really, as you can see, those guys have dumped you. They left you alone here, taking the sandwich. So I can't do the same. Like, I must be fair to you. Colleagues, can we adjourn and go and enjoy our lunch at the old assembly restaurant? All of us here, can we go and enjoy our lunch there? Yeah, let's come back at 2 to continue with the deliberations. Thanks very much. Let's break for lunch.
Is that when we were?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's recording now.